baby yet to be named is the only one to be born in a European zoo over the past 12 months. The park has launched a program to conserve Bornean orangutans that are considered as a critically endangered species. Their population has declined by more than 50% over the past century. Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea, while five didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Generations of Palestinian children have suffered due to the decades-long occupation of Palestine and the crippling blockade on the Gaza Strip, says Monib Abu Ghazala, writer, in an article titled, Why We Should Not Forget Children of Gaza. Stay tuned for more. Days after ceasefire, Gaza's children are not offered the opportunity to take a break from the trauma and to recover. It has been almost 100 days since a ceasefire was announced by the Israeli regime back in May, and since then, there has been relative peace in Gaza, for now at least. But while the extreme violence has ended, the trauma faced by Palestinians has not. Palestinian children are now facing greater challenges than ever before. Recently, a charity spoke with 10 women and children living in Gaza for its new report, Dreams for Freedom, Stories from the Ground. One of them was 14-year-old Aya, the eldest of four siblings and an aspiring writer. She says the crippling fear she felt about nearby bombs killing her family is permanently etched in her memory. Yet she tried to stay strong for her family. She said, I was very scared, but I didn't want to show it. I took my siblings into the hallway to play with them so they would forget about the war. I tried so hard to hide my fear to the point where I would stand up even when it was dangerous, just to indicate to my siblings that fear is unnecessary and that we should have a strong faith in God. For Aya and others living in Gaza, it is often their faith that helps them through different times. Generations of Palestinian children have suffered due to the decades-long occupation of Palestine by the Israeli regime and the crippling blockade this regime has imposed on the Gaza Strip. For the cycles of violence and trauma to end, the international community must come together to deal with these root causes. With the recent violence and destruction of key infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian children are now facing greater challenges than ever before. Of the 253 people killed in Gaza, at least 66 were children. Many children have experienced multiple rounds of violence in their lifetimes and, as a consequence, suffer from anxiety, depression, and the ongoing effects of trauma. About 90% of children and adolescents in Gaza have experienced personal trauma and observed the destruction of property from the Israeli regime bombing campaigns, while more than 80% have been exposed to others experiencing traumatic events. It's not surprising that charity organizations have discovered 38% of young Palestinians are at a tipping point. They admit to having contemplated suicide amid growing desperation stemming from increasingly uninhabitable living conditions imposed by the Zionist regime's 14-year air, sea, and land blockade and several military offensives in the area. Strong psychological support is urgently needed. Even prior to the recent escalation in violence, UNICEF noted that one in every three Palestinian children requires counseling, but there are not nearly enough appropriately qualified professionals in Gaza to meet their needs. While the Western world tells people that the children of Gaza suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, that is PTSD, there is no post to the trauma. Moreover, some of the hospitals and primary healthcare centers where services were being delivered were recently damaged by the Israeli regime bombs. Many children also lost family members and their homes in the recent offensive and are experiencing worsening shortages in water and electricity. In fact, over 77,000 Palestinians have been displaced in the recent rounds of violence, and 100,000 more do not have reliable access to clean water. These crises, along with the increased risk of contamination from leftover explosives, are a huge challenge to the mental and physical well-being of Palestinian youth. While the Western world tells us that the children of Gaza suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, there is no pause to the trauma. Tragically, Palestinian children are not offered the opportunity to take a break from the trauma and to recover. There is only the ongoing trauma that is inflicted by the regular cycle of bombs that are dropped on homes, businesses, and communities. While international humanitarian support is appreciated and crucial, it cannot end there. Countries must use their influence in urging the Zionist regime to end the blockade and the illegal occupation of Palestinian territories, as well as respecting basic universal human rights.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Hundreds of Palestinians have staged protests against the Israeli regime's inhumane blockade of the Gaza Strip, burning tires and hurling explosive devices toward the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories for several consecutive nights. The Israeli military, which deployed additional troops along the fence ahead of the night protests, used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades against Palestinian protesters. Several Palestinians have been injured by Israeli forces east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry's spokesman, Ashraf Al-Kedra, said several others were hurt from tear gas canisters fired at them. During Saturday night's protests alone, 11 Palestinians were injured by live fire and other aggressive measures used by Israeli forces.
I mean, it's because the laws are not being implemented, they're not being penalized, they're not being punished for all these, violations of all these laws. So they feel like they have a green light to commit more crimes and more crimes. And this becomes a natural system for the Zionists. The Zionists now, they think that they're above the law and that no law is going to, stop them from committing any crime that they want to do. And that's why you can see that whenever we hear condemnations from countries or even the nations assemblies, there's nothing really coming out of it at the end of the day.
Gazans have been organizing protests since last week. They are demanding that the crossings be reopened to facilitate the entry of goods and humanitarian aid. In a statement on Sunday, the resistance committees in Palestine announced that the protests will continue until the Israeli regime lifts its siege. The Palestinians say the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on the positions of the resistance in Gaza would not dissuade them from fighting for their freedom and dignity. Over the Israeli regime's tight blockade, which now includes deliberate hampering of efforts to reconstruct the strip following its latest war on Gaza. Back in May, the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups fired around 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war, forcing Tel Aviv to call for a ceasefire.
The only way it really works with this particular regime, and this illegitimate regime, the Zionist regime, is by righteous, unified resistance, and that's exactly what we want to see in Palestine.
Amid the ongoing confrontations, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz met in Ramallah on Sunday, marking the highest level meeting held between the two sides in over a decade. The two discussed issues related to diplomacy, economics, and civil affairs, according to a statement from Gantz's office.
You know, it's quite clear that the Zionist regime does not want peace and does not want to recognize the Palestinians, because they had a chance many times. You can see that they're still stealing, you know, areas in the West Bank, and that's obviously international law breaches. We can see now, you know, Sheikh Jabrah, Sinwan, all these different areas, even in Jerusalem, in different areas, they're still, evicting, stealing people's homes in a very, very barbaric way.
The Palestinian resistance groups have pledged not to allow the Israeli regime to continue its aggression against the Palestinian people or change the rules of engagement.
thousands of activists gathered nationwide to commemorate the 58th anniversary of Martin Luther King's Voting Equality March in Washington on Saturday. They protested against curbs to voting access in some Republican-led states that rights groups say disproportionately affect people of color. Many activists view the fight over voting rules as the civil rights issue of the era. In Washington, about 20,000 marchers held Black Lives Matter flags and signs and called on Congress to bolster voter rights. Other rallies were planned in Phoenix, Miami, and several other U.S. cities. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonprofit public policy institute, for this year, at least 18 states have adopted a total of 30 restrictive election laws, with dozens of others under consideration. Those laws range from a requirement to have a fixed address in order to register the vote to a ban on the drive-through voting that was popular in some states last year amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The organizers of Saturday's protests denounced the legislation as racist, anti-democratic voter suppression laws and demanded that the U.S. Congress pass legislation to block such voting restrictions. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden admitted that the recent push in Republican-controlled states to restrict voting access is in contrast with fair and free elections.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in fair and free elections.
The Democratic-controlled House of Representatives has passed two draft laws to limit voting restrictions. But in the closely divided Senate, Republicans have promised to block voting rights legislation. This is a sign of polarization in the U.S. Congress.
Well, I think you have to look at it in the context of the United States political sphere. I don't think voting or our system in the United States is particularly democratic from the very onset. You have to keep in mind that when the United States Constitution was first written, first ratified, you know, only white male property owners were able to vote or have any say in public discourse. And unfortunately, not too much has changed. You know, maybe there's a little bit more people of color, maybe there's a little bit more women, but the property owning part is largely still in effect, because you have the average income of elected officials at the federal level is so high. I don't think most people in the United States feel represented by their elected officials. I don't think they think our country is going in the right direction.
American society is plagued with racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group, as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. On Saturday, thousands of people demonstrated in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, and in several cities across the country to demand voting rights protection.
Our country is backsliding to the unconscionable days of Jim Crow, and some of our senators are saying, well, we can't overcome the filibuster. Then I say to you today, get rid of the filibuster. That is the monument to slavery we must dismantle. That is the monument to white supremacy we must tear down.
I march because I'm tired of elected officials putting themselves first. To be honest, I am disgusted by the behavior of many of our leaders. In this country, it's easier to register to own a gun than it is to register to vote. Think about that. If you are a congressperson protecting firearms, why won't you protect the right to vote? That is completely unacceptable. I march because I want change, not just for me, but for everyone who comes next.
While some marchers carried posters supporting the end of the filibuster, others chanted about police violence toward black people, workers' rights, the Afghanistan withdrawal, and minimum wage. This is a clear message that voting rights were not the only issue in people's minds. A top Iranian official has condemned U.S. President Joe Biden for what he called illegally threatening the Islamic Republic. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said Biden's emphasis on using other options with regard to Iran's nuclear program establishes Tehran's right to reciprocate. The reaction followed a meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett at the White House. During the meeting, Biden said he was putting diplomacy first on Iran's nuclear issue, but added he would be prepared to turn to other options. By diplomacy, the U.S. president was pointing to the talks in Vienna, Austria, to reinstate the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, which was abandoned by former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018. Biden also said he remains committed to ensuring that Iran never develops a nuclear weapon, while Iran has time and again rejected the accusation and stressed the fact that it seeks nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and not for developing weapons. Biden's threat of unspecific options came after Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, accused Iran of seeking a nuclear weapon. Gantz said military action should be considered as a plan B to prevent Tehran from accessing a nuclear warhead. That's while, unlike Iran, Israel is not a party to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, known as NPT, and is the only country in the region to have a nuclear arsenal. Israel's possession of nuclear warheads poses a significant threat to regional stability. The regime has carried a bombing campaign in Syria for the past years. It has threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions and conducted sabotage attacks against the country. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
They can reach out and touch Iran anytime they feel like it. The question, of course, is what will Iran do if they are attacked? And that's what the Americans have to consider. And their Israeli masters.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the current U.S. administration is not different from the former government of President Donald Trump, who abandoned an international nuclear deal and unleashed the most draconian sanctions on Iran. The leader also said, quote, "Behind the scenes of foreign policy, smile and self-righteous talk, America is a predatory wolf that sometimes turns into a cunning fox. An example is the current situation in Afghanistan." Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S. has a nerve to behave in a way as if it was Iran which walked away from the nuclear deal. He also blasted France, Britain and Germany for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. The leader said the trio's obstructionism in implementing the accord is no less than that of the U.S. The leader made the remarks in a meeting with President Ebrahim Raisi and his newly formed cabinet on Saturday.
So we've got basically more of the same. We've got the Trump administration with a different face that supposedly is kindlier and friendlier, but is actually just as opposed to Iran being a self-sufficient country with a functioning economy that helps its people. This is what the United States and Israel don't want.
U.S. President Joe Biden has said that rejoining the nuclear agreement is one of his top foreign policy priorities. But he has been refusing to take any steps to bring Washington back to compliance with the accord. The Biden administration has shown an unusual urge to maintain key elements of sanctions imposed by his predecessor as leverage to pressure the Islamic Republic. On the other hand, Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice.
On Thursday, the Afghan capital Kabul became the scene of carnage. Scores of people were killed after two bombs exploded in the crowd outside the international Kabul airport. The Pentagon, however, stated there was only one bomb attack. Over a dozen U.S. troops were confirmed to have been killed in the attack. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility. The blast came as hundreds of people were rushing to leave the Afghan capital prior to the August 31st deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden to fully withdraw troops from the country. Intelligence reports had warned about the possibility of attacks on the airport by an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group, which has fought against both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The U.S. president vowed revenge on the perpetrators, saying the evacuation efforts will continue regardless.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Some, however, are questioning why the U.S. chose to withdraw from this Central Asian country at this point, and if it can continue its operations in Afghanistan without having a military base there.
I think that there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they might not have thought it was important. Secondly, they were probably preoccupied with getting out. Thirdly, I'm not sure that their intelligence is as good as they say. And I think that from their point of view, they had degraded Al-Qaeda to the point that they were satisfied with. They were not focused on Afghanistan.
The outcome of the United States' longest war has also raised questions about the success of foreign military presence in the country. More than 111,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept to power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31st deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out the Al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. He has noted that the aim of the war has never been nation-building, a statement in contrast to what U.S. officials used to say when the war began.
But the fundamental issue is that in many, many cases, it's not only Afghanistan, it's been Syria, it's been Iraq, it has been countries in Africa. We've intervened in South America. Basically, without any willingness on the United States' part to recognize the sovereignty of other countries. So unless we begin to deal with that, I don't think we're going to be particularly effective in dealing with groups that we conceive to be terrorists.
Over the past 20 years, the U.S. and its NATO allies maintained a military presence in Afghanistan with the stated aim of fighting terrorists. The recent incident at the Kabul airport was a clear indication that the mission was not accomplished.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Hurricane Ida made landfall in southern Louisiana on Sunday, August 29th, as one of the most powerful hurricanes to ever hit the U.S. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading Climate Crises Converge as Wildfire Burns Western Hurricane Pommel South. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please.
Music.
Hurricane Ida made landfall in southern Louisiana on Sunday, August 29th, as one of the most powerful hurricanes to ever hit the U.S. It has knocked out power to the hundreds of thousands of residents of New Orleans and over 1 million in Louisiana, and has caused at least one death so far. Scientists say that the climate crisis has, without a doubt, made Ida more intense, as higher water temperatures offshore act as fuel to hurricanes' fire. Greenhouse gases resulting from human activity have contributed to a rise in average water temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico by 3 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 20th century. The Category 4 storm has so far blown entire roofs off buildings, devastated the Louisiana town of Jean Lafitte, and overwhelmed hospitals already filled with COVID patients. Ida's storm surge was so strong as it made landfall that the hurricane actually reversed the flow of the Mississippi River, something that experts say is extremely rare. With the threat of levee failure hanging over Louisiana, the hurricane, since downgraded to a tropical storm, is headed into Mississippi. Though many residents evacuated the region before the storm, many others, unable to evacuate, have been left behind. Some people simply cannot afford the cost associated with seeking shelter out of the storm, or may not have reliable access to transportation but out of the area, such as a car. Other populations, such as incarcerated people, have no choice either way. As Ida blasted through Louisiana, the climate crisis intensified blazes across the country. Wildfire Caldor has engulfed hundreds of homes in its wake as it has moved across eastern California in the past 2 weeks. It now threatens Lake Tahoe, where residents on the California side have been ordered to evacuate. The Caldor fire has been particularly hard to contain. Firefighters have pushed back their estimated date for containment of the fire to September 8. As the Caldor fire blazes on, the Dixie fire, just 65 miles to the north, is well into its second month of burning. At nearly 50% containment and with over 770,000 acres burnt so far, the Dixie fire is the second largest fire in California history, beaten only by the August complex fire from last year. California's weather has become drier for longer periods over the past decades as global warming and climate disruption have lengthened the wildfire season and pushed winter rains further and further back in the year. It has wreaked havoc on the state, where 6 of the 7 largest fires in the state, including the Dixie fire, have occurred over the past year or so. It's unclear if all of these disasters were caused directly by the climate crisis, but they were surely fueled by it, as climate scientists warn of dire consequences if the world continues on its current path. The western part of the U.S. has experienced record heat waves, making July 2021 the hottest month in recorded history on Earth. The converging climate disasters come as officials struggle to contain the pandemic scouring the country and contend with massive unrest in Afghanistan. Two crises that may seem unrelated but have actually been exacerbated but a climate crisis. Climate change helps spread infectious diseases, scientists have warned for years. There is evidence that air pollution, including that of burning fossil fuels, has worsened COVID outcomes for frontline communities living in areas that bear the brunt of increased air pollution. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, the Taliban has exploited the economic devastation and serious resource shortages brought on by the twin effects of drought and flooding caused by climate change to successfully overthrow the government that was propped up by the U.S. Climate unrest has been on full display through this year and the last, but nearly all of these problems exacerbate each other, solidifying the so-called threat multiplier effect of the climate crisis. California, for instance, cruelly forces incarcerated people to be on the front line of firefighting when the wildfire season rolls around, paying them such absurdly low rates that it has been likened to slavery. But with so many prisons ravaged by the pandemic, the state has had fewer incarcerated bodies to help fight the fires, making it harder to contain the blazes as they rage on.
I'm gonna come, and then I said, make sure you tell your mom now quickly and tell her to get your brothers and stuff. And she said, okay, cool, see you later. And then I said to her, see you later, and then put the phone down. That was the last time I spoke to her.
We could see people at the windows. You know, it's such something that stays with you forever. It stays etched on your mind. You can't remove it. It's awful.
Our children have experienced things that other children that are in a war zone had experienced. They saw people that were jumping out of windows, and the people that were in fire, like running out of the building. They remember the smell, the smoke, all of that.
No one has to go through this sort of pain again. Never, ever.
Grenfell Tower was a death trap because it was safer before it was refurbished.
They covered the building in essentially solid petrol.
The Conservative majority here at the council constructed policies to get rid of those people that were seen as a cost on the housing benefit.
Seeing us as troublemakers and a threat.
They would have much rather that community not be in the fire.
Institutional racism has been the elephant in the room. It's an uncomfortable truth for a lot of people because we like to think that society has progressed.
If no one goes to prison for this at all, then as far as I'm concerned, people have gotten away with murder.
The Grenfell Tower Fire. Part 1. This is the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, the wealthiest borough in the whole of the United Kingdom. It is home to the Kensington Palace, luxury department stores such as Harrods, and many celebrities and notable political figures. It is also home to one of the greatest peacetime disasters in the UK since the Second World War, the Grenfell Tower Fire.
Well, that concludes the Phase 1 hearings, and we shall be in touch in due course to let you know when we're going to sit again.
The public inquiry into the fire has now ended its first phase, with the second phase unlikely to start until 2020. Many people gave some shocking testimonies during the past few months, including firefighters as well as survivors.
He looked like he was just sleeping with a baby suit. You know, at that moment, we felt like our hearts had broken. And it had. At least we were able to tell them.
Marcio Gomez is the father of the youngest victim of the Grenfell fire, an unborn baby named Logan. He led his family of four to a miraculous escape from the 21st floor.
It was pitch black, smoke. You couldn't breathe. As soon as you open the door, you just get this woof of black smoke just come in. And it was very overpowering. We got out at 3:30, give or take, purely because we had to. The fire had come through the bedroom window, and my bedroom was on fire at that point. So I was lucky enough to spot it coming in. And when it did come in, I immediately closed my door. And I turned around to the girls and our neighbor, who was obviously still there with us. And I said, the fire's reached our flat. We need to get out. And it's now or never. There was bodies on the stairwell. Because it was pitch black, you couldn't see who or the faces. Obviously, I know my neighbors from around the tower, but don't know who they were. But it was difficult stepping and tripping over the bodies that were in the stairwell.
More than a year after the fire, Marcio still breaks into tears when asked about Logan.
I was devastated.
She's made of the hardest material I know. And without her strength and courage, I would not be here.
Sadly, Marcio's next-door neighbors, the El Wahabi family, didn't make it alive. It was the holy month of Ramadan in the Muslim calendar. The night before, the family had broken their fast and prayed together. Nur Huda, their only daughter, was revising for her GCSE exams. Our last phone conversation was with her closest friend, Yusra.
She sounded calm when she was speaking to me. She's just woken up. Me and my mum woke her up because my mum and me called her. So she said, you and your mum have been calling me. And I said to her, there's a fire in your block. I said, it's spreading a bit higher. I said, it's about on the fourth floor now. I said, tell your mum and, like, hurry up. I said, just come out. I said, because it's going a bit higher. And I said, I don't know if it's going to reach your floor or it's going to go into your flat. And she's like, oh, okay, then. And I said, hurry up then. She's like, okay, cool. She said, I'm going to come. And then I said, make sure you tell your mum now quickly and tell her to get your brothers and stuff. And she said, okay, cool, see you later. And then I said to her, see you later, and then the phone down, that was the last time I spoke to her.
Nur Huda and her family were last seen trying to escape, but at the staircase, they were told to go back up by other fleeing residents. The order had come from the firefighters for people to stay put within their flats.
Well, I think the whole basis of fire protection in a building like Grenfell, but not just that high on many buildings, is what we call compartmentation. That the idea should be that a fire should be contained within what we call the compartment of origin, which might be a room or a flat. So that therefore there should be fire-resisting walls, fire-resisting floor, ceiling, doors and windows and so on. And that should stop the fire from spreading outside of where it starts. That allows the occupants to escape from the flat and to make their way out of the building, and firefighters to then enter the building with firefighting equipment and to extinguish the fire in that flat of origin. And that's the whole basis of what is described as stay put. That is a policy of the building, not necessarily of the fire service. But the fire service operates on the basis of that advice that has been given to residents. And clearly what happened at Grenfell is that a whole system that should restrict the fire to the original flat completely and utterly failed.
Can you tell us, first of all, whether you've ever had any training or experience of revoking stay put?
No, I haven't.
Right. There's no training and no experience as far as you're personally concerned. No. Do you know whether in the brigade there was, as at the 14th of June 2017, any training on how to go about revoking stay put?
Not that I was aware of.
No.
An official report has now confirmed that the failure of the London Fire Brigade to evacuate the building immediately made all the difference between life and death. The initial cause of the fire was a malfunctioning fridge freezer in flat 16 on the fourth floor. The first call to the fire services was made at 54 minutes past midnight.
Fire brigade?
Yeah, hello, hi. In the fire, flat 16 Greenfield Tower.
Sorry, a fire where?
Flat 16 Greenfield Tower. In the fridge.
Right, hang on.
Flat 16 Greenfield Tower. It's the fourth floor.
Right, okay.
Quick.
They're on their way already. Yes, I know it's burning, but they are on their way. You've only just called, as long as you're okay.
15 minutes later, the firefighters enter flat 16 and attempt to eliminate the fire. The yellow glow in this thermal video is the fire which can be seen next to the kitchen window. Just over 10 minutes later, the fire in the kitchen was fully extinguished. Sadly, it was too little, too late, and the fire had already reached the extremely flammable cladding that covered the tower. Within minutes, the fire had raced up the exterior of the building. By 1:30 a.m., it reached the top floors. Antonio Roncolato was a resident on the 10th floor of Grenfell Tower. He had just come back from Italy the night before and gone to bed at 10 p.m. for an early start the next day. He was woken up at 1:40 a.m. by a phone call from his son Christopher, who was returning home from a late shift at work.
So when I saw the picture of the tower, I said, my God, what is going on here? So it was really, that one really shook me and it woke me up. And then I realized, oh, you know, I'm in trouble here. So I got dressed, I tried to go out, but as I touched the door to try to assess the situation, the door was very hot. Was very, very warm. I opened a little bit. I had smoke coming right into my eyes, into my face. I closed the door promptly, and I could not see anything. It was totally black, very hot, very acrid smoke. And then I went to the bathroom. I rinsed my face a little bit in my eyes, and then I said, okay, now, you know, we have to, you know, you have to really, you cannot make any mistake. You have to analyze exactly and focus what you're doing, because that could be the last mistakes you do if you do a mistake now. So I was continuously in touch with Christopher, and the fire brigade, the firemen downstairs told me, stay put, somebody's coming to get you.
Antonio was the second to last person rescued by the firefighters. He survived in his flat for almost 5 hours.
I knew that was not my day. I knew I would make it alive. I knew I had a strong conviction and faith that, yes, they told me to stay put and they would come and get me. They did. And the only thing is that my son, Christopher, because don't forget, more than 4 hours, me inside pacing around and Christopher, my son, downstairs looking at the tower burning, a torch getting bigger and bigger, you know, brighter and brighter. So basically, Christopher was very stressed. And at one stage, I had to reassure him, Christopher, be cool, be calm, because he was worried about me. He was death worried about me. And I said, because this is not my day, and, you know, You know, I'm going to make it out alive. Don't you worry.
Many people like Antonio were given hope by the firefighters that they would be rescued. They started waving white towels from their windows to make sure their flats are noticed from outside.
From what I know now, it was very difficult to reach the top floors. Although I would have preferred knowing that that was the case rather than them telling me, we're making you a priority, we're sending somebody up. If they knew they weren't going to reach, at least tell me that you're not going to reach. You know, I could have tried something different. I could have tried to leave earlier. You know, there's so many scenarios.
For the already traumatized survivors of Grenfell, a horrifying rehousing process awaited.
Well, we spent 3 weeks in the hospital, King's College Hospital. So, you know, my bedroom was a hospital bed, basically. My wife and my daughters were all put into a coma because they were trying to get rid of all the poisoning that was inside them. They were diagnosed and treated for cyanide poisoning. The Portuguese consulate was actually there the following day. So they were very quick to respond and to get there. The council or anybody like that, a whole week went past, they still weren't there.
The grieving families had to fight the council for their right to a new home. A council that was already found to have £274 million in its reserves in the immediate aftermath of the fire. Yusra lived in Grenfell Walk at the foot of the tower. Following the fire, she was evacuated along with her family, who were placed in a hotel for almost a year.
Some people think that because you're in a hotel, they think that it's cool because, oh, hotel, you get this and you get stuff, and it's nothing. It's the complete opposite. It's, you can imagine living in your bedroom and then your parents' bedroom, and that's where a family of five people had to live. That's the situation we had to live. We had to wash the dishes in the bath because the sinks were always getting blocked, and we couldn't, because obviously it was a bathroom sink, so we couldn't wash the dishes in there. So we had to get in the bath. We had to send washing off to my nan's house. We washed the clothes in our nan's house. You're literally overnight been put into something that's the size of your bedroom, and you've been put in there to live with the whole family, and it's all cramped up and everything. It's completely different. It drives you crazy. You feel like you're in a room where you're just trapped and you can't get out of it, and it's literally, you cannot get out of it until, you know, obviously until we're housed and stuff. So it's horrible. It's nothing like some people are thinking.
You do everything in that room. You eat in that room. The girls have to do their homework on the bed. You know, you watch TV on your bed. It's just a hotel room. It's made for short stays, one or two nights, maybe even a week. You know, you hang up a few shirts if you're going to work and that kind of thing, but to live inside it, it's very, very difficult. It's the basics that you realize that you miss. You know, just making some toast, putting some butter on the toast. You can't even do that. It's quite difficult.
The Prime Minister, Theresa May, had promised that all the affected families would be rehoused within 3 weeks. More than a year after the fire, there are still over 50 families living in hotels, with a further 40 residing in temporary accommodations. The rehousing process has been described as truly shameful.
Why is it taking so long? You know, I just can't imagine why it is taking such a long time just to find people homes.
Someone needs to step up, because they said 3 weeks everyone's going to be housed, but there's still people in the house today. I don't understand what's that hard.
This was not the first time fire had broken out at Grenfell. Over the 3 decades that Antonio and his son had lived in the tower, they had witnessed multiple other fires. Before some major refurbishments to the tower in 2014, all such incidents were contained within a single flat. This time, however, it was a whole different story.
I think Grenfell Tower was a death trap because the evidence suggests it was safer before it was regenerated or refurbished. All the fire safety measures which would have been designed into the building when it was built in 1974 had been compromised by what was done to the building. So the fire lifts didn't work, the smoke extraction system didn't work, the fire doors were not appropriate, the windows had failed, and of course the cladding that had been applied meant that fire, which should not be allowed to spread up the side of an or outside of a building, did indeed very rapidly spread up the outside of the building. So on every front, the fire protection measures, as we call them, were completely failing.
They had a choice between more fire-resistant cladding and less fire-resistant cladding. What they actually chose was the less fire-resistant cladding, which was at a cheaper price, marginally cheaper, because the project was around just under £10 million to do.
I just can't believe how government, central government or local government, can allow a building to be covered in what's essentially petrol, you know, in a more solid form. I know there's austerity measures and everything, you know, that everybody's trying to save money in some way or form, but you should not be allowed to save money if you're putting people in danger, you know, or at risk. And basically that's what it did.
To this day, the company that made the combustible cladding still denies responsibility and blames the failing of the windows for the rapid spread of the fire. The US-based giant Arconic describes the claddings as being, at most, a contributing factor. Professor Lawrence Harwood of the University of Reading claims to know why the aluminium cladding is the main factor to blame for the rapid spread of fire. His theory is based around the violent reaction of aluminium with water.
It's a well-known fact that aluminium reacts very violently with water, and it occurred to me that the Celotex foam insulation, which is exposed to the atmosphere, could well over time have absorbed atmospheric moisture from rain, and then started adding things together that the moisture from the Celotex foam impinging on hot aluminium could then start a reaction that would then generate a lot of heat and generate hydrogen, which would again burn, generating more heat and regenerating water. And then at some point the polyethylene could become exposed, that would then burn and produce yet more water, and at that point you'd get a runaway reaction and the fire would spread very rapidly. As soon as water hits the aluminium surface, there's a huge energy spike. A lot of energy is released as a consequence of now the water reacting with aluminium. So it's counterintuitive that water would make matters worse in that sense, but small amounts of water, so that they don't cool down the aluminium but react with it to cause this violent exotherm, will cause this reaction to occur.
It is this interaction of the water released from the insulating foam that ultimately turned the aluminium cladding into fuel for the rapid spread of fire.
The chemistry is well-known chemistry. It's undergraduate level chemistry. The question is how people put two and two together. I've spoken to several architects and building engineers, and they all have problems comprehending the idea that aluminium itself can burn violently, particularly when it reacts with water. And this, the whole idea that water makes matters worse, again, people seem to have trouble with this. But in fact, the aluminium, unlike wood burning in air, the aluminium burns in the water, and it